Going to continue on in our study today and looking at the parables that Jesus told. Now, this is our 25th parable that we're looking at today, and as biblical scholars set forth to count the parables, they'll often come up with a number that's nearly 40, but many of those parables that they put in that list are nothing more than just a like or an as statement. So it has been my desire to look at the larger extended parables, and in these we have about, 27 of those. And we are in our final group of parables then right now at this point, those which didn't really fit into good classifications with others necessarily. And then after this week we have at least two more that we're looking at, and then at that point in time, I'm going to sit down, reassess, and look through the list again to make sure that I haven't missed any major ones, which is always possible because the way we've grouped them together and the way we've been bouncing forth between the Gospels, it's always possible. So, and if you know that I've left out a major one along the way, say, hey, aren't you going to talk about the such and such? And I'll be, oh yeah, I'm going to talk about that one next week. So you'd let me know if I've missed any major ones, and I'm going to reassess as well. Certainly we know that it's easy to make mistakes when it comes to setting forth something so far in advance. But I am looking forward to the parables we're going to be looking at the next couple of weeks. The parable that we're looking at today is a little more obscure, so to say. In a way, it's... some of the parables that we've looked at are simple to understand, and then you have some that are often debated. You look at the parable of the virgins, perhaps, as being something that's very heavily debated. And all of those, I enjoyed those. I enjoyed all of them, the simple ones, the ones that were more debated. But when we come to this one, I have to be honest, is it kind of gives you a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling. As you read through and as really begin to process exactly what Jesus is saying, I've read through the parable we're going to be looking at today on several different occasions, and I guess where I was never planning on preaching on it or teaching on it, it never really kind of hit me as it did this time around. And I don't think I'm alone in that feeling as well. Certainly, as I began to look at the commentators as they began to speak about this parable, it seems to be one that is, it kind of sets people different ways. Some commentators try to twist it into something where everything is a delightful process, but it's not a delightful process in this parable. In fact, I don't know how many of you all know Brother Lewis Kiger, but Brother Lewis Kiger and I are friends, and we talk on occasion, and he was down at the Bible conference that I went to down in Alabama. He came down to that, and he, after listening to a few parables down there, he went back home and started a series on parables right away. And as he's been going through them, he's been taking a little bit different order than we have, but we find ourselves this week on the same parable. And he sent me a message. He said, "Have you preached on this yet?" Now, I have a feeling that meant that he had looked at the website and didn't find it, because he was trying to figure out what I said about it. If you're listening, Lewis, I think that's what you did. But if you didn't, that's all right too. But he sent back a message. He said, "I'm really having a hard time wrapping my head around this one." And I told him, I said, "Well, the feeling is mutual, certainly." But the parable, by the way, we're looking at is found for us in Luke in chapter 16. I should have probably told you that already, got you already turning there. But Luke in chapter 16. And we're going to begin reading in verse number 1 in just a moment. Now, as you're turning there, I will tell you that this is following, of course, chapter 15, which gave us that trilogy of parables about lost things, ending in the parable of the lost, or the, I won't say the lost son, but the prodigal son. And then as we look at that, he was speaking, of course, to publicans. He was speaking to sinners there at the beginning of chapter 15. We also know there were Pharisees in that crowd as well. And, of course, the last group that is with him at this point in time are the disciples. So in this group we have the publicans, often referred to as sinners, Pharisees, and disciples. Now, just as Jesus has just finished this series of parables on lost things, and then he And all of them point, by the way, to what? That Jesus Christ came to seek and to save that which is lost through the forgiveness of sins. And then we come to chapter 16, and the scene is still the same. That is, we haven't left the situation. We haven't went somewhere else. The same crowd is there. But at this point in time, instead of speaking directly to the publicans and the sinners, so to say, that Jesus Christ is going to turn his attention now to his disciples, and he's going to offer this parable for the disciples. Now, the Pharisees again are there, and don't worry, he'll still say some things in there that it'll make the Pharisees mad. You know, that tends to happen quite a bit anyway. But the direction of this parable is certainly directed towards the disciples. Now, what makes this parable a little bit on the uncomfortable side for us to study and to look at is that this is a negative example for us to follow after. Now, Christ has done this to some degree in parables before. We had the rich man, of course, who had the bumper crop, and he went to bed at night thinking that he was just going to tear down his barns and build bigger barns and that he was going to be fine for years to come, and he died that night. That was an example, a negative example, because we were to learn by the fact that he wasn't ready for his untimely death. We also had another negative example of the woman who cried out against the unjust judge. I called it the parable of the persistent widow, is what I like to call it, because she went to him with her continual persistence, and then, of course, eventually he gave into her desires because he didn't want to hear her anymore. And then that was a parable about the persistence of prayer, and God was telling us that, you know, he's much better than that unjust judge, and certainly we need to be persistent in our prayers. Now, today's parable, as we look at it, again, it is a negative in its example, but every single character in it is negative. Every single character in it is negative. It's not just one, but every single character is negative. And then out of that negative vacuum that is left at the end, Jesus pulls out a spiritual truth. And as we think about this, it shouldn't surprise us that Jesus would occasionally use these negative examples for us to learn by, because as we look at parables, Christ was drawn from real life. And the fact is that real life, we're not surrounded by good people doing good things all the time. As a matter of fact, we're surrounded by a lot of bad people doing bad things, and we can learn from those examples as well. So, of course, the first thing we're going to do is read through this parable, and we're going to look at the physical situation, and then we're going to continue in our reading, and as we continue in our reading, the spiritual truths will be revealed for us that the parable is speaking about. So in chapter 16, verse number 1, it says, "And he said also unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods." Now, here we have something that we see in a lot of the parables that we've seen so far, and that is we have a very rich man. By the way, this man is really, really rich. He's not just rich enough to where he has hired a steward to be the personal manager of his affairs. The amounts that are owed to him just by the two that we have in this example are a very large sum. This wasn't a guy who had some tenant farmers on his property. This was a guy who had a lot of land. And we can tell that because of the amount that was owed to him by the other people. And the amount that was owed to him by the other people would point to the fact that those men were rich. So this was the guy that the rich men owed. So you know that that guy has a lot of money, right? When he's the guy that the rich men owe. Now, again, this guy has a steward. He has a manager. This is not a slave, but someone who he is brought into this position, who he thinks is worthy to run his business, and he's supposed to be taking care of what is bought, what is sold, and what is owed. He is supposed to be keeping track of these things. Now, there is something about this steward, and that is the fact that he likes his position. He liked the pay. He liked the benefit of it. He liked the attention, but he did not like the work that went along with it. He was sloppy in the way that he did things. He was a poor record keeper, and certainly he seemed to be wasting the master's resources over and over, so much that other servants began to take notice that, hey, this guy is costing you a lot of money because of the way that he is running your business. And they began to talk to the master about this guy. Who knows, they probably were looking for his job as well. Now, so upon hearing the news, he does exactly what you would expect a businessman to do. Look in verse number 2. It says, "And he called him and said unto him, How is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest no longer steward." Now, the rich man calls the steward into his presence, into his office, if you might think of it that way, and he begins to levy the complaints that have been heard against him, and things, by the way, that were undeniable by him. The man didn't try to justify his deeds or anything like that. At this moment, he terminates the employee as well. But the termination is not immediate in nature. This is kind of like a 2 weeks notice type of thing. You know, in 2 weeks, you're going to lose your job. In the meantime, I want you to bring in all the accounts so that you can go over and show me what you've done and what you've messed up. Now, as far as business goes, that's not really a good move. Firing people is never a fun thing. I've had to fire some people in my life, and it was never easy for me. But one thing you learn very quickly, and that is when you terminate a person, you let them go right then. Either do it at the end of the work day, or if you need to, do it at the beginning, but you have them leave then. You don't want someone who is causing you trouble in business to stick around and cause more trouble, because if they were brazen enough to steal off of you, if they were brazen enough to do things while they were hired under you, once you have fired them, I will guarantee you, they won't care any more about what they do at that point in time. They will pack up everything they can and load it into their trunk before they leave. The very first employee that I ever hired in business was a young lady who, through the process of time, I found out she was turning in hours for days that she was not working. Times she wasn't there, she began to develop a very bad attitude after being caught. Things kind of went sour. She knew she was getting ready to get fired. I drug my feet around about it because I tried to give everybody the benefit of a doubt and think that everything was going to work out. But it didn't work out. She knew things were going to be bad. So one weekend, she wrote a note, left. And as she left, she stole every training manual we had in the office. So she knew she was going to stick it to me before she left. So I learned something at that point in time. If you're going to fire somebody, you get rid of them right then. You don't waste any time in doing it. You have to protect the business. And this man is going to suffer because he did the same thing. He drug his feet and didn't let him go and let someone else work out the mess that he had left. Now, look in verse number 3. Then the steward said within himself, "What shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. To beg, I am ashamed." Here we have a nice little soliloquy by the steward. You know, he's not a slave, so it's not that he's going to be beaten and reassigned to something else. He is going to be without a job very soon, plain and simple. And he begins to panic and thinking what kind of options are out there for him. He's used to living a certain kind of lifestyle, better than everybody else because of his position. And he begins to think about manual labor, and certainly he's not the kind of guy who's going to go out into the field and dig ditches, you know. It seems like there's always some place you can go dig a ditch. But the idea of digging and planting and picking is just not up his alley. And then he begins to think about begging, and certainly he's too proud for that. Truth be told, he was too proud to dig a ditch for the sake of an honest day's labor. So our steward now begins to come up with a scheme, and that is, in this scheme, what he's going to do is he's going to further rob the master. And in the process of further robbing the master, he's going to make others indebted to him in the process. In verse number 4, it says, "I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses." Since he is going to be kicked out of the master's house his plan that he has is going to force others to take him in. And this is how he's going to do it. Look in verses 5 and 6. It says, "So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him. And he said to the first, How much owest thou unto my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, Take thy bill and set down quickly, write 50. So what he does is he begins to go through the accounts, and certainly he's going to go to the ones first who owe him the most amount of money. But he comes to the first one, and he, you know, I'm not even sure the guy knows how much he really truly owes. That's how poor of a steward that he is. He asks the landowner or the person who was owing the money, how much do you owe? And he said he had 100 measures is what he owed. And he said, all right, well, let's split that in two. Let's split that in half. Now, I want to put that in perspective a little bit. A measure of oil is called a bath, and a bath is 8.75 gallons. And that was worth about 1,000 denarii, about 3 years' pay for the normal person. So there was a contract that had that was signed and stated how much was owed. And it was signed by the steward. It was signed by the one who owed the debt. Now what he does is he goes to this person and he makes out a new contract. And the new contract has his signature on it, the steward, and he'll have the person who owes the money re-sign another one, and they'll renegotiate the sum for 50, so splitting it in half. But this deal comes a lot like the Godfather. You remember the Godfather? You know, you might get a favor, but you're going to owe a favor. And that's certainly what was going to happen in the end, is these people that he was cutting these deals with were going to be obligated to take him into their homes and to help him out later on because of the way that he was discounting their tickets. So, again, this bill was cut by 50%. The steward knew that he was doing wrong. The person who owed the money knew that he was doing wrong. But they were more than willing to take that off the bill. As you can think about, that saving of 50% was very enticing, and he went along with it. Verse number 7, then he said to another, "And how much owest thou?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto them, "Take thy bill and write 80. Now again, for a little perspective, 100 measures of wheat is about 1,000 bushels, and that is equal to somewhere between 8 to 10 years of pay for a normal person. So a lot more than what we thought about even with the oil. This is a substantial sum of money, and taking off 20% of that bill sounded like a very good thing to do. And that person, too, was willing to submit to the plan, defrauding, of course, the one that he truly owed the money to. Now, the thought of the steward would have continued on doing this with others as well. You'll see that in verse number 5, he called all of his Lord's debtors. That's the idea. We're only given two, but he would have done this with all of the debtors. He would have done it as fast as he could do it because he knew that he was going to have to bring these contracts in, that he was going to have to give an account of what he did. And remember, in the end, he's not trying to save his job. He knows he's already lost it. He's already terminated. Again, what he's trying to do is to try to make it to where all these people owe him because of what he had done. He scratched their backs at the expense of his master, and certainly he expected them to scratch his as well. So, now the scene moves back to him giving an account of the contracts with his master. Look in verse number 8. It says, "And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light." Now, this verse speaks volumes about the master. And really we're looking at the first part of the phrase there before the colon here as we consider the master. You know, he takes a look at the documents. And you know what this man knows? The master knows he's been conned. He knows that he's been defrauded. He knows that new deals have been struck. He knows because of what he has done that the stewards went out. He's made new contracts. There his name is. There the other person's name is. It looks like it's a legit deal, but he knows deep down that it is not legit. He knows what the steward's done. He knows why the steward done it. But you know what? He didn't go nuts and crazy about what the guy did. He looks at him and commends his behavior. You know who appreciates a good con? A con. That's the only person who appreciates a good con. And that's exactly what this guy has certainly shown himself to be. So, that is the parable. And now Jesus is going to start to explain the spiritual application of the parable. And when we look at the parable, we look and we see all these bad people. We have a bad steward, we have dishonest contractors, and we have a con man on the top congratulating dishonest behavior of his steward. Now, this is not the kind of parable where we're going to say, well, the master is God, the steward is the Christian, and so on and so forth. We just cannot make those kind of parallels in this parable. So you can start to see why expositors don't like this parable a whole lot because, you know, all of these negative processes, and we can't put everything in a nice orderly fashion as we like to put them. But again, Christ used this parable speaking primarily to the disciples. Again, not the publicans, not the Pharisees, but he was speaking to the disciples to teach them how they should themselves consider the future, how they should consider their future. Now, the last phrase of the verse that we just read, he said that the children of this generation were wiser than the children of light. That is to say that the people of this world are more shrewd in the things of this world than those who are saved, or those that are living by the light. You know, as Christians, we can be real dummies at times when it comes to things going on in this world and how things really are. There's an old phrase that was attributed to Marie Antoinette. From my understanding, she's not really the one who said it, but she said at one time when the peasants were out there, they couldn't afford bread, she said, let them eat cake. Now, she said, let them eat cake, and that phrase has become very popular because she had no idea what went into making cake. She didn't know if you didn't have enough to make bread, you certainly weren't going to have enough for the eggs and the sugar and everything to make cake. She was that sheltered. She was ignorant about what was going on in life. And you know what, as Christians, especially Christians who are raised in Christian homes and have, you know, multiple generations of Christian families in their generations, you know, we can be very sheltered. We often have a family that believes in God. We have children that believe in God. Our friends are those who believe in God. And we just kind of live in our own little world, and we don't realize that outside of our bubble, there's a lot of bad things going on in this world. And sometimes, because Christians can become very trusting towards others because of those that they're used to dealing with, as you go out into the world and as you go out into practice, you don't understand that there are people who are trying to defraud you of what you have because they're taking advantage of your trusting nature. So, it is really not a surprise then that Christ would say something like that when you really think about it, that the children of this world are more wise to the world. I mean, that just makes sense. Now, in verse number 9, it says, and I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Now, that'll make you scratch your head. Think, what did Jesus just say? You think about what our man did. He, you know, in cutting the deals that he did. Well, mammon, by the way, is an old English word for money or wealth. The ESV says it this way. It says, "And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings." Now, think about this for a minute. Our parable had a man who made himself welcome into the homes of others because he partnered up with them and bribed them with those huge discounts of goods. Now here Christ says, "And I say unto you," or as I tell you. Who is he speaking to? Again, not the Pharisees, not the publicans. He's speaking to, again, the disciples. He is telling them to learn from the example of the world. Learn from the example of the unjust or the sly steward. And he tells them to make friends with money. Now you just heard me say that. Jesus said, make friends with money. Now, that'll make you kind of wonder, won't it? What do you mean, make friends with money? That can't be right. But think about this. Think about the parable right before this. The parable of the prodigal son. He took his father's wealth, and he went out into the world, and he had some friends, and he partied with his friends, and when the money was gone, the friends were gone, right? That's what took place there. Christ isn't talking about trying to buy friends by giving them money and treating them to a party so that you can have a place to stay or sleep for the night. That's not what Christ is saying. What Christ is saying is invest your money into the lost of this world. Invest your money into the lost of this world. Invest in the gospel. In doing so, we are reaping a much greater reward in heaven. But look again at the verse, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. Make friends with money so that when you fail, that is die, they will be there to welcome you into your heavenly home. That's a pretty decent paraphrase. We are to invest our resources into getting out the Word of God to the world. And as we do so, we are actually investing in our own futures as well. So look in verse number 10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. Now this was a common phrase of the day, kind of a little common proverb. It's a lot like if we say, if the shoe fits, wear it, or something to that degree. But this is certainly a principle, though, that we find throughout, really, the Word of God. When the faithful do the little things, then God counts it just as if we've done the big things. And by the way, until we learn to stand for all the little things in faith, we're never going to be able to stand for the big things in faith. You know, we learn a little bit at a time. Likewise, if we don't do the things that require faith, then how in the world can we ever stand for something that is bigger? If we are unjust in the least, we will certainly be unjust in much. And that leads into the thoughts of verse number 11, which says, "If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches?" So, again here, this verse is really the one that kind of just lets us know exactly what Jesus Christ was talking about. And again, mammon is speaking about wealth and righteous wealth, the worldly gain without the thought of necessarily the care of the Lord. So worldly gain. So what Christ is saying is if you haven't invested your worldly gain in this life into others, into the spreading of the gospel, if you haven't invested what you have right now, how can you expect God to entrust in you the true riches in the life to come? You know, Christ taught the disciples that faithfulness on this earth would determine what we are given in the life to come. The faithful will be rewarded with positions of higher authority, like that of rulers over cities. That is the future that Christ is alluding to here. If you fail to invest in what you have right now into the kingdom of God, then can we really expect God to entrust in us even more when the time comes? Now, again, one of the most basic principles of Scripture is you reap what you sow. You reap what you sow. You sow a lot in sweat and tears, you reap a lot in the end. Plant little, and you will have little. In verse number 12, it says, "And if ye have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own?" Well, the truth is that everything that we have on this earth is a gift of God. If we could draw any good parallels from this parable at all, it would say that God is our master. We are stewards of what He has, and we are to be faithful to invest what He has given us into others, so indeed that they might be saved. That when we fail, when we die, they will be there indeed to welcome us on the other side. So how can we do that? How can we invest in the things that God has given us here on this earth? How can we use that to invest? We can do that by giving to missionaries. We can invest in that by giving, investing in Bibles and giving those away. We can invest in things to help open up the door for us to speak to the poor of this world. There are so many ways. The ways are truly countless that we can use what God has given us here to invest in others and the spread of His Word. And in verse 13 it says, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold on or hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon." That is, you cannot serve God and money. The Pharisees, by the way, would have looked at this and thought this was a shocking thing in nature, because they fully believed that there was nothing wrong with pursuing after the riches of this world. As a matter of fact, they had a very skewed idea that the more you had, the more God's blessing was upon you. Now, Christ is telling them, you have two basic choices in life. Either you will love money and you will love everything that money brings you, or you can pursue after Him. And it's one of the two choices. And as Christians, we often find that we try to straddle the fence, so to say. That is, as we try to have all the things of this world and still yet serve God. And when you do that, it leaves you being an unhappy Christian. The fact is, it just leaves you plain out unhappy. But the fact is, you know, if you serve after God, if you choose Him, you let God take care of all the needs and things that you have in your life, and just be happy and cling to Christ and invest in Him, invest in His gospel, you will be a happy person. Do not be like the unjust steward. Don't waste time, because we don't know when Christ is coming. We have the promise of today. Invest what we have today. Now, we're going to end there this morning. Next week, we're going to turn our attention into the Gospel of Matthew. We're going to be looking at a couple of different parables from the Gospel of Matthew. There, as Jesus Christ begins to speak of the Sermon on the Mount, I think you'll really enjoy those.